Chapter 2. This time his card brought instant admission. He was bowed into the office like a successful novelist, and Tarvis grasped him with both hands. "Well, do you mean to take it?" he asked, with a lingering coquetry. "Take it? Take it, my dear fellow. It's in press already. You'll excuse my not waiting to consult you. There will be no difficulty about terms, I assure you, and we had barely time to catch the autumn market. My dear Linyard, why didn't you tell me?" His voice sank to a reproachful solemnity, and he pushed forward his own armchair. The professor dropped into it with a chuckle. "And miss the joy of letting you find out?" Well, it was a joy. Harvis held out a box of his best cigars. "I don't know when I've had a bigger sensation. It was so deucedly unexpected, and, my dear fellow, you've brought it so exactly to the right shop." "I'm glad to hear you say so," said the professor modestly. Harvis laughed in rich appreciation. I don't suppose you had a doubt of it, but of course I was quite unprepared. And it's so extraordinarily out of your line." The professor took off his glasses and rubbed them with a slow smile. "Would you have thought it so at college?" Harvis stared. At college? Why, you were the most iconoclastic devil." There was a perceptible pause. The professor restored his glasses and looked at his friend. "Well," he said simply. "Well," echoed the other, still staring. "Ah, I see. You mean that that's what explains it. The swing of the pendulum, and so forth. Well, I admit it's not an uncommon phenomenon. I've conformed myself. For example, most of our crowd have, I believe, but somehow I hadn't expected it of you." The close observer might have detected a faint sadness under the official congratulation of his tone, but the professor was too amazed to have an ear for such fine shades. "Expected it of me? Expected what of me?" he gasped. "What in heaven do you think this thing is?" And he struck his fist on the manuscript which lay between them. Harvis had recovered his optimistic creases. He rested a benevolent eye on the document. "Why, your apologia, your confession of faith, I should call it. You surely must have seen which way you were going. You can't have written it in your sleep." "Oh, no, I was wide awake enough," said the professor faintly. "Well then, why are you staring at me, as if I were not?" Harvis leaned forward to lay a reassuring hand on his visitor's worn coat sleeve. "Don't mistake me, my dear Linyard. Don't fancy there was the least unkindness in my allusion to your change of front. What is growth, but the shifting of the standpoint? Why should a man be expected to look at life with the same eyes at 20 and at our age? It never occurred to me that you could feel the least delicacy in admitting that you have come round a little, have fallen into line, so to speak." But the professor had sprung up, as if to give his lungs more room to expand, and from them there issued a laugh which shook the editorial rafters. Oh, Lord, is it really as good as that?" he gasped. Harvis had glanced instinctively toward the electric bell on his desk. It was evident that he was prepared for an emergency. "My dear fellow," he began in a soothing tone. "Oh, let me have my laugh out, do," implored the professor. "I'll quiet down in a minute. You needn't ring for the young man." He dropped into his chair again, and grasped its arms to steady his shaking. "This is the best laugh I've had since college," he brought out between his paroxysms. And then, suddenly, he sat up with a groan. "But if it's as good as that, it's a failure," he exclaimed. Harvis, stiffening a little, examined the tip of his cigar. My dear Linyard," he said at length, "I don't understand a word you're saying." The professor succumbed to a fresh access, from the vortex of which he managed to fling out, "That's the very core of the joke." Harvis looked at him resignedly. What is? Why, you're not seeing, you're not understanding what? Why, what the book is meant to be." His laughter subsided again, and he sat gazing thoughtfully at the publisher. "Unless it means," he wound up, "that I've overshot the mark. If I am the mark, you certainly have, said Arvis, with a glance at the clock. The professor caught the glance and interpreted it. The book is a skit, he said, rising. The other stared. A skit? It's not serious, you mean? Not to me, but it seems you've taken it so. You never told me, began the publisher in a ruffled tone. No, I never told you, said the professor. Arvis sat staring at the manuscript between them. I don't pretend to be up in such recondite forms of humor, he said, still stiffly. Of course you address yourself to a very small class of readers. Oh, infinitely small, admitted the professor, extending his hand toward the manuscript. Arvis appeared to be pursuing his own train of thought. That is, he continued, if you insist on an ironical interpretation. If I insist on it, what do you mean? The publisher smiled faintly. Well, isn't the book susceptible of another? If I read it without seeing, well, murmured the other, fascinated. Why shouldn't the rest of the world? Declared Arvis boldly. I represent the average reader, that's my business, that's what I've been training myself to do for the last 20 years. It's a mission like another, the thing is to do it thoroughly, not to cheat and compromise. I know fellows who are publishers in business hours, and dilettantes the rest of the time. Well, they never succeed. Convictions are just as necessary in business as in religion. But that's not the point. I was going to say that, if you'll let me handle this book as a genuine thing, I'll guarantee to make it go. The professor stood motionless, his hand still on the manuscript. A genuine thing, he echoed. A serious piece of work, the expression of your convictions. I tell you, there's nothing the public likes as much as convictions. They'll always follow a man who believes in his own ideas. And this book is just on the line of popular interest. You've got hold of a big thing. It's full of hope and enthusiasm. It's written in the religious key. There are passages in it that would do splendidly in a birthday book, things that popular preachers would quote in their sermons. If you'd wanted to catch a big public, you couldn't have gone about it in a better way. The thing's perfect for my purpose. I wouldn't let you alter a word of it. It'll sell like a popular novel, if you'll let me handle it in the right way. 3. When the professor left Arvis's office, the manuscript remained behind. He thought he had been taken by the huge irony of the situation by the enlarged circumference of the joke. In its original form, as Arvis had said, the book would have addressed itself to a very limited circle. Now it would include the world. The elect would understand. The crowd would not. And his work would thus serve a double purpose. And, after all, nothing was changed in the situation. Not a word of the book was to be altered. The change was merely in the publisher's point of view, and in the hip he was to give the reviewers. The professor had only to hold his tongue and look serious. These arguments found a strong reinforcement in the large premium which expressed Arvis's sense of his opportunity. As a satire, the book would have brought its author nothing. In fact, its cost would have come out of his own pocket, since, as Arvis assured him, no publisher would have risked taking it. But as a profession of faith, as the recantation of an eminent biologist, whose leanings had hitherto been supposed to be toward a cold determinism, it would bring in a steady income to author and publisher. The offer found the professor in a moment of financial perplexity. His illness, his unwonted holiday, the necessity of postponing a course of well-paid lectures, had combined to diminish his resources. And when Arvis offered him an advance of $1,000, the esoteric savor of the joke became irresistible. It was still as a joke that he persisted in regarding the transaction, and though he had pledged himself not to betray the real intent of the book, he held in petto the notion of someday being able to take the public into his confidence. As for the initiated, they would know at once. And however long a face he pulled, his colleagues would see the tongue in his cheek. Meanwhile, it fortunately happened that, even if the book should achieve the kind of triumph prophesied by Harvis, it would not appreciably injure its author's professional standing. Professor Linyard was known chiefly as a microscopist. On the structure and habits of a certain class of Coleoptera, he was the most distinguished living authority. But none save his intimate friends knew what generalizations on the destiny of man he had drawn from these special studies. He might have published a treatise on the filioque without disturbing the confidence of those on whose approval his reputation rested, and moreover he was sustained by the thought that one glance at his book would let them into its secret. In fact, so sure was he of this, that he wondered the astute Harvis had cared to risk such speedy exposure. But Harvis had probably reflected that even in this reverberating age the opinions of the laboratory do not easily reach the street, and the professor, at any rate, was not bound to offer advice on this point. The determining cause of his consent was the fact that the book was already in press. The professor knew little about the workings of the press, but the phrase gave him a sense of finality, of having been caught himself in the toils of that mysterious engine. If he had had time to think the matter over, his scruples might have dragged him back, but his conscience was eased by the futility of resistance. IV. Mrs. Linyard did not often read the papers, and there was therefore a special significance in her approaching her husband one evening after dinner with a copy of the New York Investigator in her hand. Her expression lent solemnity to the act. Mrs. Linyard had a limited but distinctive set of expressions, and she now looked as she did when the president of the university came to dine. "You didn't tell me of this, Samuel," she said in a slightly tremulous voice. "Tell you of what?" returned the professor, reddening to the margin of his baldness. "That you had published a book. I might never have heard of it if Mrs. Peace hadn't brought me the paper." Her husband rubbed his eyeglasses with a groan. Oh, you would have heard of it," he said gloomily. Mrs. Linyard stared. "Did you wish to keep it from me, Samuel?" And as he made no answer, she added with irresistible pride, "Perhaps you don't know what beautiful things have been said about it." He took the paper with a reluctant hand. "H. has Peace been saying beautiful things about it?" "The professor?" Mrs. Peace didn't say he had mentioned it. The author heaved a sigh of relief. His book, as Harvis had prophesied, had caught the autumn market. Had caught and captured it. The publisher had conducted the campaign like an experienced strategist. He had completely surrounded the enemy. Every newspaper, every periodical, held in ambush an advertisement of the vital thing. Weeks in advance, the great commander had begun to form his lines of attack. Allusions to the remarkable significance of the coming work had appeared first in the scientific and literary reviews, spreading thence to the supplements of the daily journals. Not a moment passed without a quickening touch to the public consciousness. 70 millions of people were forced to remember at least once a day that Professor Linyard's book was on the verge of appearing. Slips emblazoned with the question, "Have you read the vital thing?" fell from the pages of popular novels, and whitened the floors of crowded streetcars. The query, in large lettering, assaulted the traveler at the railway bookstall, confronted him on the walls of levated stations, and seemed, in its ascending scale, about to supplant the interrogations as to soap and stove polish which animate our rural scenery. On the day of publication, the professor had withdrawn to his laboratory. The shriek of the advertisements was in his ears, and his one desire was to avoid all knowledge of the event they heralded. A reaction of self-consciousness had set in, and if Harvis's check had sufficed to buy up the first edition of The Vital Thing, the professor would gladly have devoted it to that purpose. But the sense of inevitableness gradually subdued him, and he received his wife's copy of The Investigator with a kind of impersonal curiosity. The review was a long one, full of extracts. He saw, as he glanced over them, how well they would look in the volume of elections. The reviewer began by thanking his author for sounding with no uncertain voice that note of ringing optimism. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.